dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Our environmental problems are ultimately political problems. Climate change and large-scale contamination of air, water, and soil were known about and discussed in great depth 30 years ago. In the past three decades, we could have fundamentally transformed how we operate on this planet. We have the knowledge and the tools to do so. It's the political system, and more importantly, the economic system that the political system serves, that is the real obstacle to implementing existing solutions. In order for market capitalism to be maintained, sales must constantly be generated. There must always be growth in production, more sales, items discarded or produced to become obsolete so that new production and sales may generate new profits. The people who most benefit from this system are in firm control of the political structures of this society to the extent that they are able to create a veil of ignorance of the crisis as well as block already existing solutions from being implemented. Some in political power have failed to confront this situation due to cowardice. They don't want to be the ones to deliver the news that there is a problem. Instead, they give happy talk to stupefied voters. But others are deliberately and willfully working to block any attempts to deal with the problems, even in a half-assed way. These people are exemplified by the Bush-Cheney gang, who are among the most committed opponents of necessary change, and are fighting tooth and nail to continue propping up a system from which they financially benefit, but on which ultimately the clock is running out. In the second hour of our program, the Wizards of Money returns with a discussion of the Kyoto Protocol on reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and how mainly the Europeans are attempting to integrate capitalist financial markets into the fight against the greenhouse effect, and how, meanwhile, the Bush administration is actively working to block even this cautious effort to address the problem. The information is particularly timely in light of Bush's apparent success in persuading the Russian President Putin from joining the European Union's efforts to implement the Kyoto Protocols, thus leaving the world's two greatest polluter nations to rampage unchecked. We'll begin the program with a talk by environmental studies professor David Orr from Oberlin College that was given in August at SolFest, an event in California dedicated to the promotion of solar power and other sustainable systems.
Two of David's books, Earth and Mind and Ecological Literacy, have become bestsellers in the academic trade. His latest book, which comes out in February of 2004, is entitled The Corruption of Patriotism in the Age of Terror. This book has been fermenting in his mind since 9/11, and he states that the main purpose of the book is to encourage the permanent retirement for George Bush. Meanwhile, back at home at Oberlin College in Ohio, David chairs the Environmental Studies program. He teaches and advises students and oversees the Adam Joseph Lewis Environmental Studies Center. He raised most of the funds for the project as well, and it's kind of like a solar living center on the East Coast. It's a beautiful place. I think it was designed by Bill McDonough. David grew up in rural Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, where he spent his unusual childhood in the forests and the fields. Place and landscape exist for him as interior bedrock, what he would call mindscape. Most of us don't have the advantage to come at age in such a natural setting. David believes that children raised in ecologically barren settings are deprived of the sensory stimuli and the kind of imaginative experience that can only come from biological richness. Out of the verdant land of David's youth grew an intense love and respect for the earth. He likes to quote Stephen Jay Gould, who said, We will not fight to save what we do not love. David believes that what he loves is at great risk and in dire need of salvation. He's dedicated his life to ensuring that future generations develop that love for the earth that will ultimately sustain it. I'm very honored today to bring to the Soulfest stage David Orr.
Nice to be here. And what I'd like to do is talk for a few minutes about politics. And I want to start with some history. And what we know and the things on which we have been right for a long time. 1950, under Harry Truman, the Paley Commission issued a report on U.S. energy. And the summary of it was that we needed to make a transition to solar. That was 1950. That's a long time ago. In 1973 and 1979, we got hit by two oil embargoes. And what we should have learned in those oil embargoes was that we were vulnerable. We were terribly vulnerable. We now import more oil than we did in 1973 and 1979. About the same time, E.F. Schumacher wrote a little book called Small is Beautiful. And what we learned in that was that the scale of technology is a variable. It's not a given. There's no economies of scale to nuclear power. There's no economy of scale to the oil business. It all needs to go. In 1976. Well, you can applaud if you want. I mean, 1976. Amory Lovins wrote a little paper called The Road Less Traveled about soft energy paths. And in that paper, Amory, in projecting out what was U.S. oil and energy scenarios, it was common currency at the time to believe that we would use about 140 quadrillion BTUs of energy about 1990. Amory looked at the numbers, went to the other side of the supply-demand equation and said, no way, no how. You can't afford it, you can't do it, it wouldn't work anyway. Amory was right. If you look back at the numbers from 1976 until the year 2000, you realize even Amory Lovins had understated it. But we should have learned that the price of energy and its true cost weren't the same thing. And there was a whole other path to go. You can see it all around here. There was what Amory called a soft path. We could distribute energy systems to households and rooftops and fields, and there was a whole other way to think about energy. We didn't learn that. 1979, Three Mile Island. And if we hadn't noticed before, we should have noticed then that nuclear power can't be made safe. We don't know what to do with the waste. We still don't know what to do with the waste in the year 2003. Nuclear power needs to go. In Ohio, I live about 50 miles as a sober crow would fly it from a plant by the name of Davis Bessey near Toledo, Ohio. By accident, workers discovered a softball-sized hole in the crown of the reactor core. It wasn't planned maintenance. They just discovered it by accident. Somebody leaned against a pipe and the whole thing fell through. How close it was to a nuclear meltdown, we don't know. But it was a lot closer than we'd like. If we hadn't thought about it or learned it, by 1995, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climatic Change had reported that the human signature was now evident on climate. You could tell that we're driving climate into a whole different regime. Now, this is interesting because the words global warming are used to describe what's going on. This isn't global warming. This is planetary destabilization. The theory has it you can turn the temperature of the planet up just a little bit and nothing else wobbles over here. But that's not the world you read about in the morning paper or see in the evening news. That's a world where small changes here have large effects over here. Global warming, it's real. It's happening. The question is, where do we stop it? At what point? Is it 400 parts per million CO2 or 450 or 500? And then there's another little thing here. We know now that climate doesn't change gradually. It changes as kind of a step-level function, abrupt changes. But everywhere the anecdotal evidence is gathered, it supports the theory that we're pushing climate into a brand new state, Ice is melting, sea levels rising, the number of anomalous climate events is rising. The World Meteorological Association reported about a month ago that they could no longer predict weather. It's now too unstable. Hottest hots, driest dries, wettest wets, lowest lows. Everywhere you look, climate is changing. If we hadn't learned anything from 9/11, there was a lot to be learned. We should have learned that climate policy, energy policy, economic policy, security policy, and equity aren't different issues. They are different facets of one big issue, the conduct of the public policy. We still treat these as if they are separable. Quick story. I was asked in the summer of 2001, before 9/11, to go with some Republican businessmen to the White House. And the invitation came from a man who had been in the first Bush administration. And I listened to it, and I said, "Well, Bo, why me?" He said, "Well, David, you have a reputation of being a sane environmentalist." Now, I've been called worse, but I can't tell you when. And my mother, who lived in North Carolina at the time and spoke the sweetest Southern drawl you've ever heard, and she's a right-wing Republican. And I called my mother. I just wanted to let her know that my life hadn't been a total waste. And I said on the phone, said, "Mom, some of your friends invited me to go to the White House." I expected her to be happy, but she said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, Mom, they think I'm a sane environmentalist. They think I can help something." Long pause. She said, "Well, honey, they just don't know you like I know you." Cut her off my Christmas card list. 9/11 wasn't what we made it to be. It should not have been interpreted as an act of war. That was a police action. We dealt with Milosevic and Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden, none of whom have been caught. By the way, Michael Moore's next movie comes out. It's about the Bush family relations with the bin Ladens in Saudi Arabia. Now, this history lesson, and there's a lot more to be said, this history lesson really points out that our energy policy will drive climate into brand new directions. It can't be made fair. It can't be made sustainable. It can't be the basis on which we build any kind of lasting prosperity. Not now, not ever. It'll enrich a few for a time, but that's all it will do. It will lead to war. It will lead to more terrorism. And I think it will take us to fascism. That's where we're headed, unless we stop it. Now, some of you, John Schaefer and many of you, tens of thousands of people around the world, have been making a different kind of energy policy. We know after 30 years that solar works. We know that efficiency works. We know that you can generate power from windmills. We know these things. Now, this leads me to a conclusion. We don't have an energy problem. We have a political problem. What's the nature of the political problem? Well, let me give you what I think is, I wrote down some notes this morning. Here's what I think the essence of it is. There are several decks of playing cards going around. John handed me a different deck over here. This is a deck that I bought, or somebody sent me several weeks ago. This is, what's his name? George Bush. And this is the, he's the ace of spades on here. Now, the political problem starts at the very top, and let me just read this. This is a quote from Bob Woodward in Bush at War. "I am the commander. See, I don't need to explain. I do not need to explain why I say things. That's the interesting thing about being the president. Maybe somebody needs to explain to me why they say something. But I don't feel like I owe anybody an explanation." That's our commander-in-chief. The first part of the political problem is arrogance at the very top of the system. I don't have to explain. I don't owe anybody an explanation. We still have not been told who was in the room when Dick Cheney made U.S. energy policy. That is still classified information. Why is that classified? Is this not a democracy? We're just going to have audience participation. You know, y'all take a number. Let me give you a second reason. You know it as well as I do, or better. The second part of the political problem we have is the power of money in politics. We ought to get money out of politics in the same way we reportedly have gotten religion out. There ought to be a clear separation between church and state and between money and the state. And money explains a great many things. How is it, you tell me, how is it you take the morality of the robber barons, the vision of Calvin Coolidge, the foreign policy sensitivities of Genghis Khan, and make that national policy? It takes a lot of money to do that. I sit on a couple of foundation boards, and one of the problems with foundations that fund progressive things is that we scatter lots of money around to lots of different organizations. The right wing doesn't make that mistake. They give large amounts in over many years to a small number of organizations. I've got a third reason why I think we have a political problem, or a third dimension of the political problem. This is the corruption of language. And if you don't read George Orwell, read George Orwell. He had it right. If you want to corrupt a nation, the first thing you do is to corrupt its words. Now, you tell me how the word patriot came to be applied to people driving their SUV to the mall with two America flags and a God Bless America bumper sticker. How did that become patriotic? After 9/11, we weren't asked to sacrifice anything. We were asked to buy. Imagine how that would have gone down with Abraham Lincoln or Franklin Roosevelt or any other great president. How'd the word conservative come to apply to people who are merely reckless and intend to conserve nothing but the rules of the game? How is it that the word liberal, a good word, became so corrupted? Do you remember that point? If you're old enough, you'll remember the debate with Dukakis and George Bush in 1988. And George Bush Sr. had accused Michael Dukakis of being a liberal, the L word. And it was just like time was suspended for just a moment. And there was a long pause, and you wanted Michael Dukakis to say, yeah, I'm a liberal, I'm proud of it. And here's what that word means, and you're a liberal too. Liberal has a long and noble tradition. How did we lose that word? How is it we can't talk about liberalism anymore, even in a society that is manifestly liberal? And tell me, how did the word government become a bad word? Why is it we want to get government off our backs and put it in our bedrooms? How is it, or why is it, we want to get government off our backs but leave corporations there? Unaccountable power. Take back our language. Take back our words. We can't save this country unless we can speak authentically. Now, let's get real down and dirty and personal here. Part of the problem is us. Progressives. We are divided up into all kinds of factions, sub-factions, factions of factions. David Brower once said that progressives are prone to draw the wagons in a circle and shoot inward. And while we've been getting in touch with our inner child, a good thing to do, they've been getting in touch with middle America. They're down at the truck stop. They're on the airwaves. We don't have anybody, Jim Hightower and a few other folks, but we don't have anybody to counter Rush Limbaugh. And Rush Limbaugh thinks all this stuff is all environmental wackos. And we don't have a counter to that. We need to be out there at the truck stops, out on the airwaves. We need to become political. There's a lesson. I'm a professor, so everything looks to me like a kind of a lecture opportunity, and that's bad. But 19th century European socialists were divided up into all kinds of factions. Read that history. And by the time the world was ready for better ideas about how to organize its affairs, what we got out of all those factional disputes was Bolshevism. And the rest, as they say, is history. Pay attention to history. My fifth reason, or fifth aspect of the political problem, is sheer forgetfulness. I'm going to be political here in a way that may offend, has already offended at least one person, but let's be honest about this. Who gave us Watergate? Who gave us Iran-Contra? Who gave us the impeachment of a duly elected president, whether you like him or not? Who gave us a budget shutdown? Who gave us massive deficits in the 80s and now again in the 21st century? Who gave us a stolen election? We need to pay attention. Some people are counting on us forgetting our own history, not being able to get the name of things right. Remember, nothing older than last week. We need a memory. We need a sense of history. We need to know where we've been. We need to know why we've gotten where we've gotten. My sixth point is simply the kind of confusion that is engendered in American society, and I don't think it's an accident. We spend about $350 billion, we're told, to lie to each other with advertising. The average American, I'm told, spends about 4 hours and some minutes watching television, not a totally healthy activity. We are confused. 42% of the American public thinks that we found weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. A similar number believes that Iraq was directly behind the events of 9/11. We are a confused people. We have been dumbed down. We need to be able to connect the dots, see patterns and systems. This is an educational crisis. Now, let me close out with what do we do? It's easy to diagnose things. We are in a political problem. But make no mistake about it, the whole solar issue, the environmental issue, needs to be politicized in a way that honors our future, the dignity of our children, honors ecosystems, lands. Our future is in jeopardy. The first thing we have to do is to make solar and energy the keystone issue, the linchpin issue of American politics. It's the biggest thing going on. We can't make it. We can't make it to a decent future on the path we're now walking. We have to change paths. It cannot be a fringe movement. The day needs to come when that highway out here is clogged. When you have Soul Fest in a couple of years, you almost need not to be able to get here. There needs to be that many people. Then we need Soul Fest in Ohio and Alabama and Minnesota. We need a solar revolution. But we're not going to get it unless we get really, really good at politics. And that's hard work. That means understanding what the CAFE standards are. Why is it that the corporate average fuel efficiency standard hasn't budged? In fact, it's gone down to the lowest level it's been since 1980. Why is that? You need to know that. How does tax policy affect the adoption of solar technologies? How much money is given in subsidies to nuclear power, or to oil, or to cars, to all the other sources of energy? We need a level playing field. We're not going to get it level unless we pay attention to the way public policy happens and we get as good at understanding public policy as, say, the religious right did about abortion policy. Second, we need to get unified. We can't be divided up into thousands of little organizations and ever get where we want to get. I love Ralph Nader, but if you talk to him, tell him not to run in 2004. Don't confuse people. I want a green agenda, but we're not going to get it in one fell swoop. We're going to get it in small steps. It isn't going to be big, and Ralph was wrong in 2000. Gore and Bush weren't the same thing. That is just a historical mistake. We need to unify. I love Ralph Nader. If he could be elected president, I would vote for him. If he could run on the Democratic ticket, I certainly would vote for him. But we need to unify. Number three, we need to get money out of politics, and we're not going to get a solar revolution until we attack campaign finance reform. And I don't mean just to limit this campaign contribution or another one or just soft money. I mean federally funded elections. We pay for it anyway. We might as well pay up front. And while we're at it, let's address the World Trade Organization. How was it that we've lost control of our public policy, that laws passed by our state legislatures or the federal legislature can be declared null and void because some people meeting in secret in Geneva, the names of which we don't even know, deliberating by a process we don't understand and never see, can overturn what we do in this country? That's money in politics. But we'll have to also have a vision of an international world that works, and that vision has not been created yet, and that needs to include a policy for security. How do we make a world that is genuinely secure for everybody, not just for Americans? We can't build a wall high enough or big enough or a ceiling sturdy enough to keep all the threats out. We have to make a world in which people, everyone, doesn't feel threatened. Number five, I don't know. Let me see how many of you are registered voters. Hold your hand up. How many of you vote? Hold your hands up. Pretty high percentage. You know, the national numbers are that about 40% of people on the progressive side of American politics do not vote. 40% of people who would think a lot like we do don't turn out. We've got to get people registered. We've got to get them into politics. We've got to get them out to the voting booth. We've got to be political in a very direct kind of way. I've got a sixth suggestion, and this is said with some misgivings. We've got to learn from the right wing in American politics without becoming like the right wing. We can't get as nasty as Bill O'Reilly, but neither should we let him off the hook. You've seen Al Franken's new book coming out. Fox gave it some terrific publicity. My hunch is that Franken paid Fox to file the lawsuit. But anyway, it appears that it's over. But there is a lot of misinformation, which is a nice word to call it lies, about what's happening in this country and why it's happening. We need a conservative part of American politics, but we need a genuinely conservative part of American politics. The word conservation and the word conservative need to be joined in the way that Teddy Roosevelt once joined them. Yeah. I've got two other suggestions, and I want to stop. Read the Constitution. Go back and read it. We the people, in order to form a more perfect union. And it goes on and talks about due process. The word posterity is mentioned in the preamble. It's the only time the word posterity is mentioned, but it's there. Due process is mentioned in the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment. Read the Constitution. Why should we not have a constitutional amendment that guarantees the right to a decent environment to all Americans? Why? The last attempt to amend the Constitution to put an environmental clause in as an amendment was 1970. We need that amendment. That is a basic right. And while we're at it, we ought to extend the same basic protection to our posterity. They have rights that we are stripping away from them day by day. The longer that fossil fuel energy system, and nuclear as well, as long as that stays intact, we're robbing our future generations. Now, finally, my last suggestion is simply this. We need to pay attention. I don't know how you read the election of 2000 and the events subsequent to it, but my hunch is, based on what I read from the Project for New American Century and so forth, is when 9/11 happened, the outpouring of grief and quite legitimate patriotism. That was legitimate. But it was corrupted and it was used by people who reportedly, by good reports, by authentic reports, said that what this country needs is another Pearl Harbor. When it happened, they got it. They smelled opportunity. The fires weren't out. The fires actually had just begun when they smelled opportunity. And the idea of invading Iraq was mentioned apparently the next day in the White House on 9/12 with no evidentiary bridge between that event and that solution. We need to pay attention. From my perspective, we're ready. We're almost at the threshold of losing this country. The election of, or the selection of 2000 was a coup. that needs to be undone. And it will be. If you get real quiet, you can hear a rumbling out there. People like you and me are ready. Revolution may be not quite the right word, but we're ready for change. Get real quiet. You can hear the stirrings of change. It's coming. Thank you.
You just heard Professor David Orr of Oberlin College speaking in August at Soulfest in California. Thanks to Radio for Peace International for providing that material. Radio for Peace broadcasts on shortwave channel 7.445 from Costa Rica, and if you have a suitable radio, it's worth checking them out on air. RFPI is presently under attack by a new administration at the university where their studios are located, which wishes to silence the sort of information they're putting out. Please do find out more about them by visiting them on the web at www.rfpi.org, where their programming is also available in streaming MP3. David Orr just spoke about the hijacking of language, as well as his hopes that the Democratic Party could be reinvigorated to provide a meaningful opposition to the current agenda. And I'm going to read you an article continuing in that vein. The article was sent to me by an environmental and global justice activist in California, Patrick Rainsborough. He introduced the article by commenting that as he was writing the post from California, where a right-wing, steroid-addled, sexist action figure celebrity just became governor by co-opting populist resentment against the political establishment, it's pretty clear that the ability to hijack language can take you a long way. The article is an exposé on infamous Republican pollster and strategist Frank Luntz. It ran in the September edition of the liberal Democratic magazine American Prospect. We do not necessarily endorse the politics of the author, but think it's a great, albeit one-sided, analysis of the power of rhetoric, memes, that's M-E-M-E-S, to frame the debate and structure the control mythology of modern politics. Of course, Clinton and the Democrats used the same tactics. However, the Bushies and the neoconservative coup deserve some credit for removing any vestige of subtlety in state propaganda, Rainsborough wrote. The Bush team brought us the Healthy Forests Initiative, meaning taxpayer-subsidized liquidation logging on public lands, the Clear Skies Initiative, meaning polluters gut the clean air bill, and of course, the biggest whopper of them all, the War on Terror, meaning the government and their corporate buddies do whatever the hell they want for our so-called security, and we all shut up about it or else. So here is the article. It's titled, Let Them Eat Words, Linguistic Lessons from Republican Master Strategist Frank Luntz, written by Deborah Tannen in the American Prospect. Tannen wrote, I'm one of the many Democrats who watch in frustration mixed with a touch of awe as Republicans win with words, even as the labels they devise for their policies distort or belie the facts. Take the repeal of the estate tax. An estate sounds like a large amount of money. Indeed, before President Bush persuaded Congress to legislate a phase-out of the estate tax, only the largest 2% of estates were subject to this tax. But change the name to death tax, and many more Americans become sympathetic to repeal. After all, everyone dies. Death is bad enough without being taxed. How many would get all worked up about an exceedingly rare abortion procedure that the Alan Guttmacher Institute estimated represents less than 1/5 of 1% of all abortions performed in the United States in 2000? But attach the name partial birth abortion, and a second trimester fetus becomes a half-born baby. Legislation to outlaw the vaguely described medical procedure then becomes another success in chipping away at constitutionally protected abortion rights, as well as a wedge issue to defeat Democratic candidates. According to an insider in Al Gore's 2000 Tennessee campaign, the vice president's opposition to this legislation was one of the factors that turned many Tennesseans against their home state candidate. Who among us wants to call ourselves anti-life? Win the name game, and you're more than halfway toward winning the battle. Win enough naming battles, and you're on your way to winning the war. During the 2000 campaign, I was a guest on a radio talk show discussing Republicans and Democrats' appeals to women voters. A woman called in to say, "I'm for education and I'm for the environment. Bush is for education and Gore is for the environment, so I don't know who to vote for." Beyond the breathtaking oversimplification, reducing a complex set of positions and policies to being for, I marveled at the caller's conviction that because George W. Bush had declared himself for education, who on earth is against it, his policies were necessarily more likely than Al Gore's to improve education for all American children. Recent news reports are filled with stories of a mounting crisis in public education. Teachers fired, new hires frozen, class sizes burgeoning, Head Start threatened, even schools closing because the administration's gigantic tax cuts have caused enormous deficit at the state as well as the federal level, all in the shadow of the shamelessly named No Child Left Behind Act, which mandates testing and changes the formula for federal aid, but provides no new funding to improve the quality of schools or of teaching. Exploiting the power of language to persuade, despite the absence of policies to back up the words, is the openly stated goal of Republican strategy as articulated by Frank Luntz, the Republican pollster and tactician who was one of the primary drafters of the GOP's Contract with America. Luntz tests phrases in focus groups and advises Republicans on how to win votes by changing what they say, not what they do. The cynicism in Luntz's advice is astonishingly explicit. On the subject of the gender gap, for example, he informed Republican members of Congress that they could woo women with words, no need for troublesome deeds. While acknowledging that women, like the caller to the radio talk show, care about education, he cautions against trying to back up promises with actual programs. "I begin with the premise that we must do no harm. That is, we should not undermine our growing strength among working-class white men," 1994 set a modern-day record, "in our efforts to reach out and communicate to women. I refuse to advocate an educational strategy that leads to a net loss of votes just to win over a few women and silence a few media critics. It would be unwise and foolish. I do not subscribe to the notion that we must change our substance or create a separate women's agenda. Listening to women and adapting a new language and a more friendly style will itself be rewarded if executed effectively and with discipline." End quote. These excerpts come from a document that Luntz circulated to Republican members of Congress in 1997, titled "The Language of the 21st Century." The section that came to my attention was "Addressing the Gender Gap," but it provides a blueprint reflected in Republicans' rhetoric in other areas as well. Luntz's advice boils down to this: forget action. Improve your image by revising the way you talk. Let them eat words. Prominent among the words Luntz advises Republicans to use in their speeches is "children." Women consistently respond to the phrase "for the children," regardless of the context. From balancing the budget to welfare reform, "for the children" scores highest of all arguments offered. Therefore, rather than creating a compassion agenda, Republicans need to create a communication framework that involves children. Luntz also advised, Conservative is a more popular label than Republican. Put these pieces of advice together and you get compassionate conservatism. This is not to claim that Frank Luntz advised George W. Bush directly, but the president's speechwriters seem to have absorbed the lesson. From the beginning of his campaign for the presidency, Bush's speeches have employed the linguistic manipulations that Luntz recommended. During Bush's presidential campaign, children darted in and out and played around in speech after speech. For example, toward the end of a campaign speech to the New Hampshire Chamber of Commerce, Bush proclaimed, "In all the confusion and controversy of our time, there is still one answer for our children." In a speech he delivered in Indianapolis on the economy, children appeared 12 times. In the New Hampshire talk, a dizzying 35 times. This last is less surprising because the speech was, after all, about education. But that in itself does not account for the thrumming repetition, not only of the word children and its variants, but also of the words heart and dream, 3 each, love, 8 times, including lovely and loveless, and the runner-up after children, hope, which along with hopeful and hopeless appeared a whopping total of 10 times. The welter of words that stir emotions, and in particular the word hope repeated as an incantation, can also be heard as echoes of Luntz's advice. "Politics remains an emotional area," he writes, "and television has made fear a very saleable commodity. But fear alone is not enough. The commodity Americans most desire, and the one in shortest supply, is hope. First, however, the fear." For example, in his New Hampshire speech on education, Bush reminded parents, "In an American school year, there are more than 4,000 rapes or cases of sexual battery, 7,000 robberies, and 11,000 physical attacks involving a weapon." Then, following Luntz's advice, the GOP must restore the American dream of hope. Bush claimed that the problem with education is not a matter of education per se, surely not a matter of how much funding is made available to schools, but of the diminished hopes of our current system. He went on, "Safety and discipline are essential, but when we dream for our children," there's that phrase "for the children," "we dream with higher goals. We want them to love learning, and we want them to be rich in character and blessed in ideals." Bush further declared, "Everyone must have a first-rate education, not because of the value of education itself or because it provides opportunities for upward mobility and escape from poverty, but because there are no second-rate children, no second-rate dreams." True to Luntz, these emotionally evocative words were backed up by no concrete proposals to make schools better. Just the cost-free promise that charities and faith-based organizations would be invited to establish after-school activities on school grounds, and that students who attend dangerous schools will be given a transfer to a safe school. The practical implications of this proposal are mind-boggling. Would the schools in poor neighborhoods stand empty as their students are bused en masse to wealthier counties? Bush did propose additional funding, not to hire more teachers or improve schools, but for the prosecutors and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives to prosecute and convict children who bring guns to school. It's the government's role to create an environment where everyone can dream and flourish, to help people build and dream. The purpose of prosperity is to make the American dream touch every willing heart, because changing hearts will change our entire society. The greatness of America is found in the loving and generous hearts of its people, close quote. If you think these exhortations sound like an inspirational sermon or a seminar led by a New Age guru, you're right. They do sound like that. But in fact, they were part of a plea for campaign contributions on the website georgewbush.com. Indeed, just about all of Bush's campaign speeches were studded with hearts. When speaking in Iowa on farm policy, he called agriculture the heart of our economy. On the military, he proclaimed that we need to tell veteran stories to the next generation, to raise a monument in their hearts. And just as preachers and inspirational speakers craft their rhetoric to reach an emotional peak toward the end, so too did Bush in his campaign speech to the New Hampshire Chamber of Commerce. Our problems as a nation, he intoned, will only be solved by a transformation of the heart and will. This is why a hopeful and decent future is found in hopeful and decent children. This last sentence reflects another Luntz directive. Not only does it give us one heart, one children, and two hopes, it looks to the future rather than the past. At several points, Luntz's Language of the 21st Century pays homage to the public speaking skills of the Republican Party's nemesis, President Clinton. When Bill Clinton trumpeted his Bridge to the Future theme at the Democratic Convention, Luntz writes, it really was over for Bob Dole. Luntz applies this lesson to women voters in particular. Women want their elected officials to plan for the future, not just live for today, he writes. But again, this doesn't mean that Republicans, when elected, need to actually plan for the future. It's just a prescription for rhetoric. Every speech must end with your vision of the future, Luntz advises. Every speech should conclude with a message of limitless dreams, unending possibilities, and the promise of a better future for ourselves and our children. And there it is. Bush's New Hampshire speech ends. In all the confusion and controversy of our time, there is still one answer for our children. If we love our children, this is the path of duty and the way of hope. By adopting emotional language without changing policies, Luntz tells them Republicans can have it all. Like Pavlov's dogs, voters will come running if you ring the right verbal bells. When applied to women voters, this advice makes me cringe with particular unease because it's reminiscent of my book, You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation. In it, I explain that many women are frustrated when they tell a husband or boyfriend about a problem and he tells them how to fix it more often than not. What she's looking for is the reassurance that he's willing to listen and that he understands how she feels. This sounds frighteningly to me like what Luntz has to say on the gender gap. He writes, from getting the kids out of bed, fed and off to school, to the demands of work outside the home, women are working longer and harder than ever, and they want to know that their elected representatives understand this. Tell them. Empathize. Take the time to let them know you truly understand what they are going through. But wait. Understanding may be all that a woman is looking for when telling her husband or boyfriend about something that frustrated her that day. But when they go to the polls to elect a leader, women, as well as men, are selecting not a soulmate, but a public official whose job is to solve at least some of the country's problems, or at least to address them honestly. I see another parallel, too, between lessons women have learned when their styles contrast with men's, and lessons Democrats can learn when their styles contrast with Republicans. By harnessing the power of language in absence of action, Republicans have managed to have their cake and eat it too. On the one hand, they pursue policies that benefit the few. On the other, they garner votes from the many. Perhaps it is the very fact that Democrats have the policies and the record to justify their appeal to the many that they haven't thought as much as the Republicans about what words will galvanize voters. It's a bit like women who believe that if they did a good job, it would be recognized, only to see their male colleagues getting the credit and the promotions. Recall the excerpts I quoted at the start. Luntz promised that changing words, not works, would be successful if executed effectively and with discipline. This caveat was not casually tossed out. He cautioned Republicans that good communication is more than just words, phrases, and messages. I'll pause here for a moment to give you a chance to predict how you expect Luntz's next sentence to read. Okay, here it is. As a party and as a movement, we will fail if we continue to go it alone or change messages daily. We can only succeed when we work together and talk together and stick together as a team. Only through a movement-wide effort and constant repetition can our voices unite in perfect harmony. Devising labels and phrases that win over audiences regardless of the facts is only a beginning. The big trick is getting the labels to stick. And that's where the unity and repetition come in. Democrats have long envied the Republicans their party discipline. Now they can add discipline in agreeing on the words and phrases to use when describing the policies that Democrats oppose or support. Frank Luntz wrote The Language of the 21st Century in 1997, before President Clinton succeeded in balancing the budget and President Bush succeeded in creating the largest budget deficit in American history. Now that the tables have turned, Democrats could take Luntz's advice. We need to simply state, we must not mortgage our children's future to pay for the mistakes of today. We need to simply ask, what does this do to the children? And I was reading an article, Let Them Eat Words, Linguistic Lessons from Republican Master Strategist Frank Luntz, written by Deborah Tannen and published in The American Prospect. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE, Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. Wizards of Money is next.
The wonderful Wizard of Oz. Well, here he is, the Wizard of Wiz, if ever a Wiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a Wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz has won. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the Wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is the Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series, but with a twist. My name is Smithy, and I'm a wizard watcher in the land of Oz. This is the 21st edition of The Wizards of Money, and it is entitled Playing Russian Roulette in the Carbon Markets. In this, the 21st edition of The Wizards of Money, we're going to take a look at the hottest market on the globe. Well, it's actually the market designed to cool things down a bit, the global carbon market.
Just might cure your depression, but carbon is a girl's best friend.
When we make decisions, we want to make sure we do so on sound science. Not what sounds good, but what is real. And the United States leads the world in providing that kind of research. The approach taken under the Kyoto Protocol would have required the United States to make deep and immediate cuts in our economy to meet an arbitrary target.
Last month, there was finally an agreement between the Commission, the Parliament, and the European Council, which is the member states, on how to put together a European emission trading system. The system is relatively sound in terms of the structure of it, the monitoring and verification. I don't think anybody's now expecting the US to join in this round. It's not just about rejecting Kyoto as such, but the US, and this really went under the Clinton administration as well as the Bush administration, has largely adopted not to do anything about climate change. some of the U.S. climate team does seem to spend a disproportionate amount of time in Russia. So I think, on the whole, the U.S. administration would prefer to see Russia not ratify, simply because the continuing existence of an international regime to deal with a problem that the Bush administration says doesn't exist is probably a bit of embarrassment.
CO2E is a subsidiary of Cantor Fitzgerald. We are brokers, and we broker all of the global emissions markets. So I run the global business. Really, all of the global emissions markets for greenhouse gases are all inspired by or caused in one way or another by the Kyoto Protocol. The EU system is huge. It's 25 countries. It's going to deal in allowances which have an issued face value of about 20 billion euros per annum.
Well, what we're going to do next is to take you to the Senate floor on Monday, where Senator Inhofe spoke. He was speaking about the issue of what he calls environmental extremists, and the whole issue of global warming.
I've offered compelling evidence that catastrophic global warming is a hoax. That conclusion is supported by painstaking work of the nation's top climate scientists.
Let's go back to the medieval warming period. The medieval warming period happened between about 1000 AD and 1350. And during that time, the Earth was actually warmer than it is today.
Look, my liege! Camelot! Camelot! Camelot!
It's only a model.
While the United States has developed a sudden fascination with the so-called Dark Ages, a time when the Earth was much toastier than it is today, the rest of the world is looking forward and has decided to do something about man-made weather impact. Most developed nations have now ratified the Kyoto Protocol of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, including all 25 member states of the European Union, as well as Canada and Japan. By ratifying the Kyoto Protocol on climate change, these countries have pledged to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by a significant amount over the next decade. This pro-Kyoto world has given up on the main country that has refused to ratify the protocol, the United States of America, who doesn't seem the least bit embarrassed by their noticeable gaseous emissions. Forging ahead, the Kyoto team holds out hope that Russia will join them by year-end 2003. Which would finally bring the Kyoto Protocol officially into effect. In anticipation, this pro-Kyoto world is gearing up for compliance and is implementing new regulations, markets and market mechanisms, indeed a whole new way of doing business globally that the US is now being left out of. This episode of The Wizards of Money will explore the developments in the global carbon markets that have taken place mostly outside of the United States and get very little attention in this country. These developments include the world's first international market in carbon-based financial instruments, national taxes and levies on corporate energy use, and even a tax on cow farts and burps in New Zealand. To get to know these new markets, we'll talk to the Director of Global Operations at CO2E.com in London, the carbon emissions trading subsidiary of Cantor Fitzgerald. I will also talk to an energy specialist for the Climate Action Network in Brussels. But first, we'll start with a refresher on the cycle we can't afford to ignore anymore, the global carbon cycle.
But carbon is a girl's best friend. And gold may be grand, but it won't start a fire in your barbecue or put the toot in your choo-choo. 'Cause life on Earth is carbon-based. It came here on rocks from outer space and formed organic compounds till the carbon cycle went round and round. Carbon is a girl's best friend. Well, there may come a time when you need to do some squeezing. Carbon is the world's hardest friend. And there may come a time when a substrate is needed to deposit your film on.
Summerloo, Vandadoo. Then graphite is the allotrope for you, 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 you. Or if you're into ages, then carbon 14 can date it. Carbon is a girl's best friend. Well, I've heard of attempts to make hard carbon nitrides, but diamonds always win in the end. You know they do, darling. And I've heard that we need to find something much cleaner to put into our cars, or else we won't get very far, 'cause time rolls on and supplies.